All right. Hello, my beautiful listeners. You're tuned in right now to the Left Side of Liberty podcast. And today I'm doing my first podcast. And so today is going to be a little bit of an overview of how this podcast will go. So let's jump right into it here. So this podcast looks at politics, economics, and news through a libertarian socialist and anarcho-communist lens. And it will be a mixture of news and commentary and political and economic theories, you know, discussions about those topics. So I will take you through my ideological evolution, and then I will go in more in depth as to what I mean when I say I'm a libertarian socialist or anarcho-communist. So, first of all, I started out as a liberal, you know, just a standard liberal Democrat. And then around 2015-ish, when I started getting deeper and deeper into politics, and I saw how just how awful the Democratic Party had become around 2015, 2016, I was like, maybe I'm not all that liberal, or maybe I'm not, maybe that's not the correct term to describe my views. So I went looking elsewhere. So there's another political word that begins with an L, which I thought, well, I'll try that on for size and see how it fits. And that was a libertarian. Now, when I say libertarian, I mean the American-style anarcho-capitalist libertarian. So I basically believed that businesses are right about everything. Businesses can never do anything wrong, especially because they're in this to please their customers. So if they don't please their customers, they won't thrive and survive in the so-called free market. And, you know, selfishness is moral. It's actually a moral thing. And the nanny state doesn't help anybody, and nobody really likes it. Nobody uses it. A lot of people use it. Nobody should. That's what I meant to say. Nobody should. Then I thought, well, that's not necessarily me either. So what am I really? So these two concepts, I tried to reconcile these two concepts. Number one, I want individual freedom and liberty. I don't want the government telling you what to do. I don't want a big bloated state dictating all my decisions, all my family's decisions, all my small businesses' decisions. I don't want gigantic red tape all over everything. I don't want the government to regulate the shit out of everything. But at the same time, I do want a relatively egalitarian society, and one that is not based on greed and corruption. So, or just a lust for power. So, in other words, that's centralization right there. So I wanted the decentralized society, but at the same time, I wanted it to be free and relatively egalitarian. So I thought, how do I manage that? Well, it turns out that there is an ideology that is perfect for that, which is libertarian socialism or anarcho-communism. Now, those two terms I most often use indiscriminately, I guess you would say, interchangeably. That's what I was looking for. I use those terms relatively interchangeably, although there are some slight differences. But really, the only difference that I can really surmise from this, that I can really only spot from this, is from those two terms, is I think libertarian socialists are more tolerant of some sort of a market system, be it labor notes or some kind of currency that you can't really mess with very much and the state can't manipulate because there would be no state. So they're a little bit more tolerant of a market system and currency than anarcho-communists, which is anarcho-communism advocates for basically a completely resource-based economy, and you basically take what you need and go on about your life. So that ideology suits me perfectly in that I don't like centralized bureaucratic states, but at the same time, I do think that we can achieve a relatively egalitarian society. That doesn't mean I want everybody to have 16 cars and 12 houses, okay? That's not what I'm talking about. What I mean is, I think everybody deserves to be able to survive in society, and I think we have the resources now to be able to make that happen. So that's what I'm talking about when I say I want a relatively egalitarian society, meaning that I want to give everybody an equal opportunity to survive. Now, that brings up another good point, which is that in some cases, social democracy is like that, but you still have big, bloated, centralized states that boss everybody around and tell them what to do. So that's where I kind of disagree with social democrats. Plus, they still have currency and largely a free market, albeit regulated, but still pretty free. So that's where I kind of diverge from the social democracy school of thought. So that brings up yet another point, which is that social democracies such as Norway, Denmark, Iceland, Sweden, Finland, Greenland, those countries are classified as social democracies, and you'll have some people calling those countries socialist countries, okay? And they really aren't, you know, that they are very capitalist still. They are heavily regulated, but regulation isn't necessarily a socialist principle. It's not necessary for a socialist society. It's not a typical component if you actually look at what socialism is, which is workers controlling and owning the means of production, or the community owning it as a whole. That is not necessarily what happens in social democratic societies. So again, countries like Norway, Denmark, Iceland, Sweden, Finland, those countries are not socialist countries. And neither, by the way, are countries like the USSR, Maoist China. China, especially today, is not exactly a communist country. North Korea, Venezuela, all the typical right-wing sort of scapegoats and sort of straw men of socialism and communism. Those countries are not communist or socialist in any way, shape, or form. Why do I say that? Because the functions of the capitalist system have not been abolished in any of those countries, and the workers in those countries don't have a damn thing under their control. They don't control a damn thing. So these countries are not socialist or communist. And another key thing is that the, as I alluded to early, just a few seconds ago, the functions of the capitalist system have not been abolished in any of those countries. They have been undertaken by the state. So this is in sort of lefty economic socialist Marxist theory. This is what we call state capitalism. And it makes sense because think about it. You can still, there is still a monetary system in each of these countries. It still issues currency. It has a very, very tiny marketplace. It just so happens that only the elites and the government can benefit from the market system. So it's basically poverty and the consequences of corruption for everybody else. But for the government, you get a market system and you get the benefits of marketplace corruption. So and government corruption. So that's what a state capitalist system is. So again, socialism and communism advocate for worker control over the means of production in a non-hierarchical society. State capitalist systems do not abolish the capitalist system. They simply, the state itself simply undertakes the role of being in control of the capitalist system. So, which sounds more like socialism to you, given what I just said? Do these countries, the Soviet Union, Maoist China, North Korea, Venezuela, do these countries sound anything like actual socialist countries to you? You know, and if they do to you, I'm sorry, but you've just, you spent so much time steeped in Western anti-communist and, you know, and anti-socialist propaganda and capitalist, pro-capitalist propaganda that, I'm sorry, if you haven't figured it out by now with the information I've given you, I'm sorry. You know, it's just, you don't understand my economics. You don't understand the differences between a socialist economy and a state capitalist economy. I'm sorry. But I would implore you, my beautiful listeners, I would implore you to read authors like Kropotkin and Bakunin and Chomsky and even somebody like Bookchin or there's another, or even Marx, you know, go and read Marx. You know, I don't necessarily consider myself a Marxist. I agree with him on some things, but on other things, which I will get into in a later podcast, I will get into my agreements and disagreements with him. I do have some pretty major disagreements with him. I would say that I'm closest ideologically to Noam Chomsky. I would say that he's my, the closest that you can get. If you want to understand my views, go read a Noam Chomsky book or listen to one of his lectures or speeches, you know, and just listen to what he has to say. I'm not asking you to agree with what he has to say. I'm just saying that if you want to learn more about my philosophy, read a Noam Chomsky book or listen to a lecture or a speech or an interview that he's given. So now, let me go through just real quick the steps, I guess you would say, to a sort of, it's a gradual process. I'm not one of those people that advocates for an immediate revolution where one day we have a capitalist economy and another day, you know, the next day, we have a completely libertarian socialist society. That's not necessarily what I advocate for. What I want is gradualism. I want the gradualism to be relatively quick, but I think that we should have a transitional period where once the owner class, the capitalist class is overthrown, I think what we should do, we should first have a democratic socialist system, which sometimes gets conflated with social democracy, but it's not the same thing. And this is why I have a bone to pick with people like Bernie Sanders, because he's the one that really popularized this misnomer and this mistake. So social democracy, as I alluded to earlier, is a market system, a capitalist system that is heavily regulated, which also has a robust social safety net and slightly better working conditions and worker freedoms than a capitalist system like ours. So that's what a social democracy is. What a democratic socialist system is you have workers that still own and control the means of production, but they elect government representatives to make sure their interests are fulfilled and maintained. That's what a democratic socialist society is. So basically, it's a society governed by workers' councils, which again are direct representatives of the workers, because they're directly elected by the workers themselves. They're not like labor unions, which are just government-appointed bureaucracies, you know, that these bureaucrats just... And to be honest with you, shitty unions are better than no unions at all, but unions as they exist today, especially in the United States, are not the ideal solution for workers' rights. So that's one step in the transition, is democratic socialism, actual democratic socialism. Then you move on from that and you go to libertarian socialism, which again, in certain theories and philosophies, still maintains somewhat of a market economy. Like, for instance, mutualism is a supporter of the labor note system, which basically you write down, I worked, I don't know, let's say 40 hours a week, and then you would take that to a mutualist store and say, hey, I worked 40 hours a week, give me, I don't know, 40 bottles of water. I don't know. So 1 hour of work gets you a bottle of water. And then you would negotiate on a price from there. So that's how the labor note system works. So that would be more in a mutualist / libertarian socialist society. And then the anarcho-communist society would be one that is completely resource-based and not based on any type of currency. Basically, you just take the resources you need and, again, go on about your life. Now, I'm not, like, utopian enough to believe that. I still have a relatively utopian vision of society, but I'm not utopian enough to believe that all crime and all corruption, I guess you would say, will cease to exist. Of course that will exist, but the point is that in this system, it will be much less than in the capitalist system, which is based on corruption and ruthlessness. You have to be ruthless to survive in the capitalist system. You know, if you're not, like, for instance, Noam Chomsky made a great point about the stock market, where working people vote against the interests of other working people, because how do you get stocks to go up? Well, part of that is making sure wages are as low as possible so the stocks can be as high as possible. So that hurts other workers and may even hurt you if you're still working and you have your savings and retirement in a your sorry your retirement fund, not savings, retirement fund in a 401k plan in the stock market. It's in your best interest to have those stocks go up. So again, part of the reason, like part of how you make those stocks go up is if you keep wages relatively low. So that is a huge conflict of interest because on the one hand, if you're a worker, say in a manufacturing plant, you want your wages to go up. But at the same time, if you're investing in, I don't know, Apple or Microsoft or one of those tech companies, you don't want them to be paid very well because it's not in your interest. You want those stocks to go up. You want those stocks to go up. And that's partially, not completely, but partially how those stocks go up. Another example is there's this myth that mostly in ANCAP and conservative circles that basically a business owner will want to please his workers so they won't revolt. And in some cases, I agree, but in other cases, what if you can't afford to pay your workers well, or what if you say at least that you can't afford to pay your workers a decent wage because you have to meet a certain profit margin by the end of whatever business quarter it is. So you're going to do whatever you can to meet that, even if it means cutting wages or keeping them the same if they're relatively low. So because again, it's in your best interest. It's in your very survival in the capitalist system to be ruthless, you know, even if you're a perfectly nice person and good person outside of your business practices, you know, it just requires that ruthlessness. Now, that's what differentiates me from even some people that probably agree with me on 90% of the other stuff that I just said, which is some people I think do view certain business owners, and they are certain business owners are inherently greedy and evil in a sense, but not all of them are like that. However, the system itself thrives on greed and ruthlessness. So, while the people may not necessarily all be ruthless, that's what the system thrives on, the capitalist system. So, it is kind of a myth that, oh, you know, the bosses will want to please their workers and they want to have customers, so they'll treat their workers right because if the customers find out that they don't treat their workers very well, then they'll just move to their then they'll just move their serve their take their business elsewhere and you know do business with another firm. And again, that sounds nice in theory, but what if you have a local deli, let's just say a deli that doesn't pay their workers very well, but you don't have another deli to go to for another 10, 15, 20 miles, and you don't have a car. So it's not very feasible to go to another deli. So, like, what are you gonna do? You don't really have another option now, do you? So that's another thing to say about that. So that's in general what my economic views are. And so now I'd like to move on to more, I guess you could say, relevant topics. as of late. So, first is my assessment so far in the 2 years that we've had him as our president. I want to give my honest assessment of Donald Trump. Now, on the campaign trail, half the time, Donald Trump made perfect sense. He's like, yeah, let's get out of these stupid wars and let's renegotiate NAFTA and let's get out of all these stupid trade deals that benefit other countries while screwing us over. Let's get out of all these really awful raw deals that have cost Americans billions of jobs, and you know, let's stop outsourcing jobs from to China, to Mexico, to India, wherever. You know, let's rebuild infrastructure at home. Let's not spend on military interventions or foreign aid abroad, which again I agree with. Let's not let NATO screw us. You know, let's get out of NATO. All this stuff that really, really resonated with me and I really agreed with. But then the other half of the time, he would also say, let's bomb the shit out of the Middle East. Let's take their oil. Let's do this. Let's do that. You know, especially since he's been in office, instead of helping the working class, he's actually hurt it mostly hurt it. I mean, this, what's it called? UMSAKA or whatever they're calling it now. USMCA. Yeah, USMCA. That's it. The new trade deal. Okay, NAFTA on a scale of 1 to 10 was maybe a 3, and this is a 5, but so it's like nominal, marginally better, but it's still not that great. It helps just a little bit, but it's still pretty similar to the old trade deal, so I'm going to give him half props on that one, but certainly not full props. So that's one aspect of it right there. And also, this presidency really, really reveals the hypocrisy and the inconsistency of certain conservatives. What do I mean by that? Well, Trump has repeatedly done things in office that Republicans claim that they hate. Like, for instance, when Barack Obama was in office, he inherited a $1.4 trillion deficit from, it was either 1.3 or 1.4 trillion dollar deficit from the Bush administration. And he cut that down to about half a trillion, you know. So, and then he gets no credit from that, for that, from people like Fox News. He gets no credit for that. But Donald Trump, increases the deficit from, you know, $500 or $600 billion to some articles I've read even project that it could go up as high as $900 billion by the beginning of next year, which is coming up pretty soon. So you have $600 billion to $800 billion. When Trump was like, oh, we got to cut the deficit, we got to worry about the debt, you know. So where are you, Republicans, worrying about the debt and the deficit? Isn't this something that you care about? Like, I thought this was something that was very important to you. Now, the debt and the deficit are not all that important to me, quite frankly. I mean, yes, it's important, but I don't hold that nearly as important as conservatives do. So that's one aspect of it. And the other thing is Trump promised to be, you know, the forgotten man will never be forgotten again. But he's hired like 6 or 7 different Goldman Sachs officials into his administration. He expanded the number of interventions, military interventions, from 7 under Obama to 8. He added Niger for good measure. Yeah, and that, you know, what the hell did Niger do to us? You know, so you got to ask yourself, every time we start a new intervention, you go, okay, what do they have that our government is interested in? Because that's what it is. That's what we do now. We fight wars not for ourselves or to protect our allies or whatever, which even then, a war to protect our allies, unless it threatens us directly, I'm not necessarily in favor of. But anyway, the point is that we fight wars for corporate profits. That's it. That's really the only reason. And, of course, for geopolitical reasons as well. But mostly for corporate interests. So I'm not really sure why I went off on that. Oh, right. Because Donald Trump said we got to get out of all these stupid wars. And yet he added another one for good measure and has increased drone strikes 432% from the Obama administration, which was bad enough as it is, and escalated Bush's drone program. So it's just escalating, escalating, escalating. And as bad as Obama was on foreign policy, although he wasn't weak, as conservatives would say. I mean, he was weak in the sense that he didn't use diplomatic options and he caved to the Republicans and the neocons at every turn on foreign policy. But Trump is worse. Trump loves the neocons. He loves John Bolton, you know, and people of that ilk. He loves Mike Pompeo. So he's listening to these people that are just rampant war hawks. And so he's like, okay, you know, I don't want to make you guys sad, so I'll do your bidding, sure. You know, so that's my brief, relatively brief, mixed opinion on Donald Trump. He's done a couple of okay things, but mostly it's just been a disaster, his presidency. And also, one more thing, his tax plan. So the middle class tax cuts that he that were included in the GOP tax bill, that provision expires. It has a sunset provision. It expires after 10 years, and the tax cut for the rich never expires. It's completely permanent. There's no loopholes, no, you know, it's completely permanent, whereas the middle class tax cut expires after a decade. And, by the way, the tax bill was something that I initially gave him a little bit of credit for, but then I learned, apart from learning the sunset provision, there's one other thing where I was like, oh my God, I was fooled. 83, keep that number in mind, okay? 83% of the benefits of these tax cuts, the financial benefit of these tax cuts, goes to the top 1%. That's it. That's all who's benefiting from this, guys. 83% of the benefits go to the top 1%. And so that means that for 99% of the country, you don't really see much benefit. And especially if you're in the middle class and the poor class. After that, yeah, you get, you know, slightly lower taxes for 10 years. But then after that, you get a tax hike and you're screwed again. So it's not, so Trump is not the sort of working class hero, the ex-oligarch turned working class hero kind of persona that he tried to convince everybody that he was. So that's just utter bullshit, and it's something that I think doesn't get discussed nearly as much as it should, because the mainstream media, they are corporations, and so they're not going to promote and talk about stories that upset corporate profits. So, speaking of the media, so this is the last item that I have for you guys, but speaking of the media, there's this weird disconnect between, and not even just from the media, but also from mostly conservatives and people like Fox News, who they think that they know how the Democratic Party operates. And as somebody that's been in both parties, you know, both major parties, I can tell you that Fox News and the Daily Wire, the Daily Caller, all these conservative sources, they have no idea how the Democratic Party actually works and functions. Not even close to a clue how the Democratic Party works. So, as an ex-Democrat, let me tell you how the Democratic Party actually works. So, a good example of this is Tom Perez pretending to endorse Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And that was about, I don't know, a year ago or whatever when she was campaigning. And recently that was brought up on Fox News on the show Outnumbered. It was brought up by Kennedy, who half the time I actually agree with what she says. You know, she's pretty good on most social and domestic issues. And she's a libertarian, or at least a conservative libertarian. So I agree with her on some things, but she was talking to the panel on Outnumbered about the tweet that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said, where she was like, "Oh, the $21 trillion missing from the Pentagon would be able to fund a third or two-thirds or whatever of Medicare for All." Now, Kennedy and the rest of the panel was right in the sense that that's not actually true, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez screwed up on that tweet. She totally goofed. Okay, that's admitted, and she has made a couple of other goofs in the beginning of her political career here. But she's young. She's doesn't have a whole lot of experience. She needs to think before she says things, because I know that she is a very intelligent and bright young woman. She just needs to be more careful with what she says and how she says it and how she comes across. So, granted, I'll grant the panel that, but when I forget what her name was, like Martha or Molly or something like that. She has blonde hair and glasses. And she's the supposed liberal on the panel. So when she said, "Oh, you know, Tom Perez doesn't really, she said no one in the Democratic Party is holding her up as the future of the party, because I forget who the others were on the panel, but the ones that I do remember that were on the panel are Kennedy, the blonde, spectacled, fake establishment liberal, and Harris Faulkner. So those guys were, you know, having this back and forth. And so Kennedy said, well, wait a minute now. Who runs the DNC? And the lefty goes, Tom Perez. And Kennedy was like, well, he said that she is the future of the Democratic Party. So case closed. But it's like, Kennedy, come on. You know, I really do. I love you. I love Kennedy, you know, at least, you know, and I agree with her on like 60% of things. But my God, Kennedy, you do not understand the basics of how the Democratic Party works. Do you not understand? And she doesn't, but it's a rhetorical question. Do you not understand that Tom Perez is a perfect representative of the corporatist wing of the Democratic Party? Hillary Clinton, Chuck Schumer, Kamala Harris, and we'll get to her in a second. Nancy Pelosi, even Kirsten Gillibrand, and even half the time Elizabeth Warren. You know, that's what he represents. What Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez represents is the sort of Bernie Sanders, Ro Khanna, that sort of wing of the party, which is pretty small, and half of Elizabeth Warren. So that's that wing of the party, and the Tom Perez wing is different, and it's a political calculation. He's trying to make it seem as if the Democratic Party is unified, but it's not. So Kennedy, you have no idea how the Democratic Party works. And it's interesting how the supposed leftist on the panel, the blonde Martha or Molly or whatever, something with an M, how she immediately, as soon as she was pressed on kind of quasi-defending Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, she was like, oh, I don't defend her. I'm not defending her. I'm not defending her. Not defending Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Not defending Bernie Sanders. You know, Bernie Sanders isn't even a Democrat, which technically that's true, but he caucuses with the Democrats. So basically, the furthest left position that you have on Fox News in that conversation is, yes, Medicare for All is wrong. Bernie Sanders is discredited. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is discredited. Although, shouldn't she get maybe a 1% pass for kind of being new? You know, so that's the furthest left position that you have on that panel. And then you have Kennedy chiming in again saying, well, you know, socialism is an economic system, and you need an argument for that. And she doesn't understand basic economics, so, and her ideology is based on a foundation of yogurt. Oh my God, Kennedy. Oh my God. Again, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is not a socialist, and neither is Bernie Sanders. They are social democrats. There is a difference. Again, these people favor a market system with heavily regulated capitalism and a robust welfare state. That's what a social democracy is, and that's exactly what Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez advocates, and that's exactly what Bernie Sanders advocates. So you're just dead wrong on that point. And also, it's not fair, although she made a goof, Cortez I'm talking about, although she goofed a little bit, it's not fair to say, to just smugly lecture her and say, well, you don't understand basic economics, you know. It's like, well, Kennedy, if you understood basic economics, you wouldn't be an ANCAP now, would you? You know, so it's like right back at you, you know, tough love, you know, because like I said, I do like Kennedy a lot. And I think she's, you know, most of the time, she sounds semi-reasonable. But she has moments like this where it's like 40 to 50% of the time, she's just insane. You know, so it's just, it's incredible. It really is. That she is lecturing Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez about not knowing what the hell she's talking about, when Kennedy, you don't understand what the hell you're talking about in regard to the Democratic Party and in regard to anarcho-capitalism, which isn't even feasible in the real world. I'm sorry, but that's the truth. And Kyle Kulinski, when he covered the segment, by the way, I recommend all you guys check out the YouTube channel Secular Talk if you haven't. I would definitely recommend checking them out because he, Kyle, does a very good job. He's very articulate, and he's a pretty smart guy. He knows what he's doing. So check that out. And I like what he said. He was saying that Kennedy, you think you're an intellectual, but you're not. What you are is an Ayn Rand, Friedrich Hayek, Ludwig von Mises Kool-Aid drinker. That's what you are, and that's exactly right. Kyle got it exactly right. So that's just the reality, Kennedy, and you've got to read more about socialism before you talk about it. Again, socialism has nothing to do with redistribution of wealth. It has nothing to do with regulation. It has nothing to do with any of that. It has nothing to do with the safety net. It's simply about worker control over the means of production, preferably in a non-hierarchical and horizontally structured society. That's what real socialism is about, and somehow we've got to get that message across, and that's partially my goal for this podcast. So that pretty much wraps it up for me today, but before I go, I would just like to say that I'm going to try to do this podcast for now for 2 times a week. Might be a little hard during Christmas, but we'll see where this goes. So I will definitely try and see you guys, not see because I can't see you, but you know what I mean. I will communicate with you guys again sometime this week. So I want this to be a twice weekly deal, and I hope you guys will tune in next time here on the Left Side of Liberty podcast.